Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segreto, and this is Franchise Today. Boy, it's been a busy week as far as for myself and for my co-producer, Joe Caruso. Yesterday, as we completed the Franchise Social Media Summit 2011, which was a nine-hour event I facilitated throughout the day. Joe was one of our key speakers in the franchise sales track. And I have Joe with me today, and we'll be on throughout the show. Joe, welcome.
Good afternoon, Paul. Glad to be here. But I feel like I've been with you for a long, long time. The days are running together, and yesterday was a marathon that felt like a nine-hour sprint.
Yeah, it definitely felt like a sprint. We even ran into a technical problem, which we were able to resolve very quickly, which I was quite surprised about and happy about. But it's really great to see some great results and great comments coming back after 4 months of planning for such a monumental event, first of its kind within franchising. 9 hours of content, great information, 8 speakers, including yourself, and also a 9th speaker, Lon Safkow, the author of the Social Media Bible that was on the show last week. 9 hours. I mean, people are just shaking their head right now, trying to grasp it all. And of course, they'll be going back and listening on demand over the next 2 months. We had an audience that spread out over 5 continents. I think it was about 14 different countries. A lot of different brands that were out there, just beyond my wildest expectations. And I really appreciate you being involved in it.
Well, it was a terrific event, especially since this is Social Media Week around the world. And I think it's evident from the participation and of the attendees and the speakers that social media in franchising is getting a great deal of traction on the consumer side and on the franchise recruitment and development side. I think everybody's coming to the conclusion that you got to be in it to win it, and if you're not, you're at a disadvantage and your competitors are going to eat your lunch.
Absolutely, and this is one of those things that they're definitely not going to be able to fake it until they make it. There's just too much going on. I mean, you're right. We're right in the middle of Social Media Week internationally. They were part of our sponsorship in respect to the Social Media Summit, although we were not a live event in person. We were a live virtual event, which was kind of outside their realm, but still they endorsed us. They were happy to see franchising's involvement in Social Media Week, and I look forward to great things down the road with them and be able to expand our boundaries. The audience, like I said, we had a couple of CEOs on board. We had a host of marketing executives. I mean, all in all, it was just a great event, and we're looking forward to the next one as we're scratching the surface right now on a franchisee social media event, and which we'll be announcing here pretty quick. Moving forward, you know, I'm going to be in Dallas tomorrow and Saturday, as well as in Denver in 2 weeks, attending Greg Nathan's Franchise Relations Boot Camp. And as you know, Greg was on a special edition of Franchise Today several weeks ago. He had 2 parts. Quite a prolific speaker, probably better than anybody you know with respect to franchise relations. Greg's team at the Franchise Relationship Institute down in Australia has put in a lot of effort over the last 20 years perfecting methods and processes with respect to franchise relations. And Franchise Today Show and Franchise Essentials are both proud sponsors of the event. If our listeners have not yet signed up, I'm sure we could get you in the door tomorrow in Dallas or in 2 weeks from this past Tuesday. It was so it's in 12 days up in Denver. Certainly worthwhile. Joe, I know you've had you've talked with Greg over the years, I believe, haven't you?
I've read his books, and I have had conversations with Greg physically and through email.
Right. I mean, he's just a remarkable speaker. Should be about 150 in the room both times. I've seen him speak at IFE events, at the IFA convention. Remarkable speaker. I hope to be able to bring a lot back to the table as we move forward. Today, I know we have John Gordon as our guest, Principal of Pacific Management Consulting Group. But before we get to John, Joe, who's going to be on our show next week? Tell our audience.
We've got a great guest, Ben Letalian. Has a company called Franchise Well. Ben is also an adjunct professor at Georgetown University, and he teaches a week-long course on franchising. And he was just a speaker this week live at the Capital Area Franchise Association in D.C., and he's going to be talking about social franchising, but not social media. He's talking about franchisors aligning themselves with social causes, charities, and making it part of their business model, from allowing charities to become franchisees, but more so to be able to have a mission that is associated with the charity and the brand, and leveraging that so that both parties benefit. It'll be a terrific program. Ben has been in franchising for 20 years on the franchisor side of the equation. So it's something to look forward to, and I encourage everybody to tune in next week for Ben.
Well, that'll be great. I'm definitely looking forward to it. As we progress in our third season on Franchise Today, we do have some special things planned throughout the year. Of course, the third annual Franchise Legal Series will be in the spring. Of course, you can still listen to the first and the second annual legal series on demand at blogtalkradio.com/franchisetodayshow, along with all our other segments of Franchise Today. And we continue to be flattered by our audience, as we're constantly told that many franchisors are using the content from Franchise Today within their own systems for their own staff's training, which is really very flattering. And that's certainly kudos to you, Joe, for putting together a great lineup. And speaking of lineup, if anybody has any suggestions for future topics or guests, by all means, send them to myself or to Joe, and we'll consider it and look at it. Although we are packing it in for the entire fall, it seems like we only have a few openings left. What are some of the things that our listeners can expect in the fall of this year for our third season?
Well, we're talking with a number of guests, and as always, the Franchise Today show has really been about best practices in franchising and using the tools for franchise recruitment, management of franchise systems, and effectively and in a compliant way. So we've got a number of guests. We haven't got firm dates for all of them yet, but I think people will be very, very pleased with the content, because it's the thematic aspects of what we have going forward have been as good or better than what we've had in the past, and we've had some terrific topics and unbelievable guests. And some of them will be coming back again.
And something that we'll be doing, I'll be at the franchise or at West Coast Franchise Expo November 4th through 6th, I believe, in Los Angeles. And I won't be broadcasting live, but I will be interviewing people in Los Angeles at the show, various franchisors that are exhibiting. And so if you're going to be down there, I'd love to talk with you. And hopefully we'll have enough content to to do a special edition show, and if that works out, we'll do the same thing at Franchise Expo South at Miami in January, and then again at the International Franchise Expo in June. And I'm proud to say that Franchise Today and Franchise Essentials are proud sponsors of all three of those events, and actually doing a lot of the social media work for MFE Expos that manages and produces those great events. But without further ado, I'd like to get moving on to how to be a winner, a restaurant franchisor. As I mentioned, John Gordon, Principal of Pacific Management Consulting Group, is our guest today. He's a finance and economics expert who provides research and niche earning analysis, management consulting and advisory expertise to those who need to know about franchise and chain restaurants, hospitality, and multi-unit retail sector companies. John has a track record of success and over 30 years' experience in business, spanning roles from hourly associate to chief financial officer to management consultant with companies such as Booz Allen Hamilton, Ponderosa, and Burger Chef. And Gordon is an expert in management systems, benchmarking and performance measurement, restaurant unit economics, franchise unit return on investment analysis, and is a graduate of Indiana University. John, welcome to Franchise Today.
Thank you, Paul and Joe. Thank you very much for having me today.
I think you might be the first Hoosier we've ever had on Franchise Today.
Oh, very good. We are out there.
Yes, you're out there. Absolutely. You know, as I often do with Joe, he brings to me various potential guests and topics. And quite frankly, I was very excited when we first started discussing having you on the show because we do talk a lot about best practices, franchise recruitment, marketing, et cetera, but have yet to have somebody on the show specifically talking about you know, restaurant franchisors and the unit economics and everything that goes along with being a great restaurant franchisor. So I really look forward to talking to you today. So we definitely are excited and want to know about being a winner restaurant franchisor. So let's begin by sharing with the audience how you earned your stripes in food franchising and how you've seen the industry evolve.
Well, certainly. I am a longtime restaurant worker and observer and analyst. I got my stripes, as many did in the sector, by starting in stores, in restaurant units, in hourly and unit management roles as I was working my way through college, and then multi-unit supervision roles in the quick service restaurant sector, QSR, Burger Chef, Hardee's, that great combination. And then when I was a bit older, I was promoted into the corporate office. I was a cost analyst. I was a financial analyst. Later, I was a director of financial analysis and budgeting, and then chief financial officer for a large hospitality organization that had quick service restaurant operations worldwide. And then management consulting. The management consulting bug bit me, and I spent a couple of good years at Booz Allen learning the craft and the trade, and in 2003 I opened my own niche analytical firm, and that is exactly what we do. We do deep dive analysis and research, all 100% focused in the restaurant sector.
Well, I mean, it sounds like a very interesting segment of you know, franchising and of course, of business. You know, and I've done a little bit of consulting on the food service side, and it always amazed me at the attention to detail that goes into a lot of the operations. I spent a little time with CC's and always marveled at how you possibly can make money at a $3.99 buffet, especially with a guy like myself that likes to eat, and definitely they're not making money off me at $3.99. But I was really impressed with the detail to percentages of toppings and sauces and different things. So I know that it is a lot more intricate and a lot more tedious than the average person knows. And I guess as you analyze, evaluate, and measure, you know, various chain restaurant operators, I guess the first question that I have to come up with is, who are your favorite franchise chains?
Well, great question. And there are multiple dimensions at looking at this, of course. And, of course, looking at it, you know, principally from an analysis or a measurement standpoint, there are a few folks that stand out. Obviously, analysis in measurement and metrics are important to anyone, be it investor, be it chain restaurant operator, be it potential franchisee. It's one dimension of the business. Obviously, people go into this in order to make money, and that is certainly understood. But you know, I continue to be to this day, through yesterday, through today, amazingly impressed with McDonald's over a very, very long time period. And you know, everyone has talked and studied about McDonald's a tremendous amount. They certainly weren't the earliest quick service restaurant franchisor, but they have built an amazing legacy and an amazing organization, you know, over the last 60 years. And it shows up in their financial reporting and in their disclosure. I feel that they do, for an organization that is fundamentally 80% franchisee owned and operated, they do a good job of breaking out their very complex business, you know, the four different revenue and cost and profit streams that they have, as well as providing solid information about how franchisees do.
Joe, prior to the show, you and I were talking about McDonald's, and McDonald's came up several times yesterday during the Franchise Social Media Summit. And you brought up an interesting proposition of sorts when you said how McDonald's being so big can exponentially change markets. You made reference to, you know, just think if McDonald's bought every McDonald's store manager an iPad, or if every employee at McDonald's were to get an iPhone, how it possibly could shift the Apple stock. And I really thought about that for the last hour since we talked this morning, and really just started shaking my head and saying, you know, yeah, you're right. They're so big and so strong. Give me a little bit of your insight to that.
Well, I think that McDonald's is iconic in terms of a brand, and it's iconic in terms of a model. I mean, everybody aspires to be the next McDonald's. And what I was trying to say about the Apple nexus with McDonald's in terms of McDonald's if they employed their products was that, you know, if McDonald's developed an app with an iPhone app and gave an iPhone to all of their employees so that it integrated with their point-of-sale system, it integrated with their communications with their employees, and they were to buy all of those, I don't think it would not only move Apple stock, it would move world markets. And it just goes to show you the power of that brand. And, you know, if they buy just one thing for every store, if they buy just one thing for every employee, or every franchisee, it's dramatic and it's exponential. I also think that getting back to John, it's interesting the span of success for McDonald's, because McDonald's has peers that predate them. I mean, why didn't A&W do what McDonald's had done? Why are they not bigger than McDonald's since they actually had a head start? White Castle, which doesn't franchise, another brand that predates McDonald's by a long time. Crystal Hamburgers, I believe they, you know, predate McDonald's. but nobody seemed to have replicated the McDonald's success to the magnitude. Now, certainly, Subway has more units than McDonald's, but I think they're entirely different companies, and they're almost not even comparable. What do you think about that, John?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Joe. While Subway has a lot of units, of course, you know, maybe a thousand or two more than McDonald's, you know, their average annual sales per location is far less than that, you know, only one-fifth or one-sixth that of McDonald's. So, of course, the McDonald's total sales share is considerably larger. But McDonald's, you know, there were chains that predated, certainly White Castle and also some of the San Bernardino, California chains, Baker Burgers and also In-N-Out, you know, actually got a little bit earlier start, but McDonald's was able to grow because of timing issues, because of management and leadership that came together, and also because they had a vision, you know, for example. And McDonald's did use franchising. They were certainly working it, you know, as early as 1958, 59, you know, as I can see going back and looking at McDonald's history. So they were able to grow. The Ingram family for White Castle and the In-N-Out group, of course, they didn't want to franchise, and they wanted to build slowly debt-free In-N-Out, for example, just ferocious about no debt. Part of their core beliefs, and same with the Ingram family with White Castle too, I believe. So many things came together for McDonald's at the right time. They got, you know, America was changing during that period of time. We were evolving to the post-interstate era, and you know, the creation of interstates and more mobile automobile-driven culture that we have. McDonald's was there at the right time at the right place, but at the same time they also had a very, very interesting management team. You know, Ray Kroc was not much of a restaurant operator; he was more of a salesman, of course, as we remember his background. But he was able to bring in operations people. He was able to bring in financial people, and it all kind of came together.
But well, wouldn't you agree that the one thing, despite the opportunities that were available to McDonald's in the late 1950s, early 1960s, with the advent of the interstate highway system, the creative destruction and new technologies that brought forth, Ray Kroc made a box where franchisees could make money. Franchisees could get a return on their investment. And wouldn't you say that was one of the hallmarks of what he did for McDonald's?
Absolutely. You know, one issue that comes to mind, you know, just very, very quickly, very immediately, is on the supply chain side. Ray was from the very beginning set the standard that he didn't want, and McDonald's didn't want to have vendors, you know, paying off McDonald's, so to speak, with rebates and special fees and concessions that would possibly undermine store level economics. He was very, very firm on that, and that really was a hallmark that was built, you know, as just one essential element, you know, over a period of time. Another thing, quickly, is just on the whole real estate side. McDonald's, from the very beginning, saw itself as a real estate operator and as a hamburger operator and as a franchisor. It was able to buy real estate over a period of time, which helped it capture financing at a period of time when banks and other lending institutions wouldn't even think about restaurants or 15-cent hamburger places. But at the same time, because McDonald's owned the real estate, they were able to help franchisees in the early years with, as they were building up with a so-called variable rent structure, lower and then higher over a period of time.
You know, it's interesting. It wasn't without tumultuous events in the early days for McDonald's. You know, you and I both come out of the Hardee's kind of system where Hardee's had bought, you know, the Burger Chef chain. Hardee's had bought Sandy's. A lot of people don't realize the Sandy's chain was started by former McDonald's franchisees who broke away. And you know, it wasn't easy. And Ray Kroc, because he was investing so much money in real estate, their cash flow was spotty at best at different times in their early years of development.
Very much. Interesting story about how Harry Soderbergh, who was the McDonald's franchisee, or excuse me, the McDonald's finance expert, went to biweekly payrolls rather than weekly payrolls at one critical point because McDonald's was so low on money they couldn't make the next Friday payroll.
But their balance sheet looked pretty.
Yes. Yes, and the real estate especially, because it was just so hard in the early days to get financing. And we all know that money is so important in building any kind of organization or any kind of business.
But, you know,
it's
bringing
funny,
it to Jim. Present day, you know, what do you see in terms of franchisors who are building a better box, building a vehicle for franchisees to be successful? And if you're thinking about being a franchisee, and if you are a franchisor, what kind of metrics do you have to make available through your franchise disclosure document, through your if you're publicly traded, through your SEC filings? What are those things that you mentioned earlier that McDonald's does very, very well that these operators today can adopt?
Certainly. And McDonald's is one of the franchise disclosure document disclosures that reveals and notes franchisee performance just about the way that I would do it if I was, you know, if I was king for a day and I was rewriting SEC regs and if I was rewriting the FTC franchise rule and the like. McDonald's actually reveals average unit store volume from high to low, a high point, which in the U.S. last year was about 9.6 million, down to a low point, which was about $400,000, and then it shows sales bands or literally bands of sales. The average McDonald's sales AUV, average annual volume, in the United States is about $2.4 million. McDonald's displays a sales band right above it and a sales band right below it. They show a $2.2 million band. They show the $2.4 million band. They show the $2.6 million band. So, you know, they are no doubt displaying the vast bulk of the system. You know, imagining a typical, curve, you know, a typical frequency distribution. But they also show cost of goods, resulting gross profit, operating expense, and then the so-called franchisee operating profit. And I really think that is almost ideal in terms of what disclosure can be and should be. Very closely corresponding to the franchise disclosure document is the other mandated SEC requirement, which, of course, if a company goes public, there is a S-1 filing, which actually is the prospectus, if you will, you know, of the company. And then, of course, once a company is public, a SEC 10-Q or 10 quarterly report, and then an SEC 10-K or annual report is required. I think that format, essentially the format that McDonald's uses, can be incorporated easily into both the S-1 or the quarter end in the annual 10-Q and 10-K process.
Well, John, you know, and I agree with you, and I think McDonald's does some things that are just extraordinary. And I think there's people in the audience right now that are hearing this saying, yes, that's extraordinary, and there's no way I could ever do that. I've got 50 units. I'm an emerging brand. I think we've got a pretty good concept. I'm not publicly traded. I don't plan on being publicly traded. My franchise disclosure document does not have an item 19 financial performance representation. I can't do that. And so I might have wasted my time listening to that segment of the show, but I don't think so. And I think you're going to tell them why.
Absolutely. And you're right. And we do have to consider everyone on the entire curve in terms of what can be done, what should be done over a period of time. Well, and to that point, so first let's look at, you know, what we're fundamentally saying is we need to show and display the average annual revenue, the average annual sales for, and this can be for any franchisor, not necessarily a restaurant, but it could be a hotel, it could be a cell phone, could be a mobile store, application, cleaning service entities of any type. You know, at some point you have a basic business unit, and the franchisor is and should be vitally concerned about whether their royalties get paid. They have to have this. They just literally have to have it. They should logically and properly should be able to and do audit their franchisees, you know, over a period of time to assure that the proper royalty is paid, that the sales chain is basically good. As an example, any franchisor will need access to capital along the way, and they all need access to capital along the way. Right now, they are virtually shut out of the market if they don't have audited financial statements of some kind from somebody. Doesn't necessarily have to be from a Big Four firm, because the Big Four firms, of course, are picky in terms of who they work for. But you've got to have audited financial statements somewhere. And should there be a franchisor that literally has no franchisee units, then if they have a company unit, they could certainly show those same two metrics for the company stores, along with a notation that these represent company stores and different expense adjustments to get to a franchisee equivalent is necessary. So that would even handle a situation where there is no franchise operations at all and only company operations. To the EBITDA standpoint, to the earnings, the operating profit, as McDonald's calls it on their franchise disclosure document. Likewise, that is a metric that every bank, every lending institution, anywhere in the United States and dare say the world needs. They're going to ask for it. It's what the debt covenants, you know, the actual debt standards, you know, how much debt, can I or must I or should I remain underneath? That is always the universal metric. And if a franchisor is not collecting that data, then you know that actually says something about the franchisor. It says something about the system. The franchisor gets and should earn its royalty by providing a good business platform for franchisees to grow. There are many ways, particularly, and keep in mind, we're not talking about quarterly numbers here. We're talking about an annual, one time a year data. They need it if they don't have it.
Well, and I think you've moved into an interesting tangent in terms of what you're talking about, operations. And a lot of people that are listening, because their audience is primarily franchisors, they say, well, I'm getting top-line sales. I know what my franchisees are doing, and I know how much royalties they owe me because I'm polling the store electronically. I've got the reports coming in. I see it dynamically. But what they don't get, and I think it's the dirty little secret of franchising, is they don't get a unit-level P&L. And for those that get unit-level P&Ls, oftentimes they have no idea how the single-unit or multi-unit franchisee is financed. They have no idea of how much debt they're carrying, what the coverage is, and how well they're doing. And arguably, you can't really do that on an annual basis. Certainly for audit purposes and measurement, you're going to need a 12-month period or 13-period meeting range of time. But what do you have to say about the actual reporting from the support side and those people that either loathe to get those reports from franchisees or believe that they actually can't get them?
Right. And certainly it is an issue and it is a respected note. But what I would say is we all know, and any franchisor today, and I'm sure you've talked about this on many earlier editions of this program, and we'll no doubt talk about it a lot in the future, which is the primary imperative of franchising is growth. That is the primary goal, and in order to grow, of course, money is necessary. Financing is necessary, not only for the franchisor, but especially for the franchisee, because they are the ones that are investing in the property, plant, and equipment, and other fees, you know, over a period of time. We all know how constrained the lending environment is and has been, you know, essentially since markets and conditions began to collapse in the summer of 2007. If a franchisor wants to grow, then they're going to have to help provide this information and to get lenders on board. You know, for example, right now, for a medium-sized lender, even a medium-sized lender, I'm not talking about Bank of America or Wells Fargo or GE Capital, I'm not talking about them, but even for a medium-sized lender, hardly anybody wants to look at anything under, you know, a $1 million in the EBITDA, or even $5 million is a common symbol, common benchmark, if you will. So, you know, for smaller franchisors, where's the money going to come from? IFA just presented lack of credit availability as a prime problem for the entire franchising sector, and lenders are also coming back and saying, "Help me out here." You know, we do have to do due diligence. We do have to set the risk premium. If nobody has any numbers, how are we going to do it?
Well, it almost sounds impossible. But I think you're going to tell us how you actually can the really great franchisors, because you know not every franchisor can be a winning restaurant franchisor. Only some people can win. So how do those people that really want to toe the line and talk the talk and walk the walk actually succeed?
I think they succeed, as we know, with any organization or any business or government or our personal lives. In relationships, whatever, you have to have some systems in place. You have to have some business systems and some organizational systems in place. For example, let's go back to the small franchisor again. Someone that's just beginning to get some forward momentum. You know, for example, well, of course, many franchise agreements call for the franchisor to actually approve turnover or new franchisees, you know, coming on board. If unit X, Y, and Z is sold to party ABC, you know, for example, then the franchisor must approve that. And that is certainly a logical point, even if the franchisee community said, heck no, I'm not sharing my numbers with anybody. That's a very logical point that the franchisor could get it, and there are any number of other potential areas within the franchise agreement which legitimately the franchisor should proscribe behaviors and prescribe reporting that this could be accommodated.
And I think most of the audience kind of knows that, and I think you're absolutely right. What my experience has been is franchisors tend to not take the time to make it easy, gentle, and worthwhile for franchisees to report, because they don't put anything in there that's in it for the franchisee. Franchisee already thinks, well, I know what my numbers are. Why do you need to know them? What am I going to get out of it? How does a franchisor thoughtfully and artfully and maybe in an elegant way come up with a solution that gets them what they need, what you just described, but also gives something to the franchisee that is of value in terms of intelligence and data?
Sure. Great question. And, you know, my first reaction always would be, other than for the good of the system, which is that, you know, in general, as the system gets bigger and more franchisees come on board, the system should be able to have more negotiating weight, have more media weight, bigger systems. There are, as we all know, there's huge economies of, and advantages of scale nowadays. But the franchisor certainly could prescribe a simple, elegant chart of accounts and reporting structure, you know, if you will. All of these businesses are very volume and revenue volume and cost centric. That's everything nowadays. And if they're not teaching that, or if they're not instilling that as part of the business model that goes forward, what I traditionally find is that everyone knows the need of tracking results and then reacting and monitoring them and trying to do something to make them better in the future. Everybody knows that, okay? No one much argues about that. But what I have found over a period of time working with both small franchisors, observing large franchisors, working with them, you know, over a period of time, being in corporate staff roles, you know, as I have been with franchisees on board, the process is just too difficult, and it can't be ascribed to, you know, hey, mail me in your annual financial statement at the end of the year. That's just not good enough. It's too hard. It leads to the differences in chart of accounts and definitions. If the franchisor would define terms and use those terms throughout as a common business language, and even provide a electronic pathway for this highly summarized common definitional data to be submitted, it would make things a lot easier.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, and you're right. You can have a great franchisee operator that is a horrible bookkeeper. And if you create a cumbersome reporting structure, that's not going to entice them to want to participate in any real way. And the thing about numbers is the older they get doesn't make them – it's not like wine. They don't get better with time. And I mean, in terms of reacting to what you've discovered from the numbers, if you're only getting on an annual basis and you define a problem, or you can see that a problem occurred in the first period or second period, it's probably too late to really do anything about it.
Right. That's exactly right.
Paul Segretto show, and this has been the co-host actually asking a lot of the questions. Paul, I'll let you take back over.
Well, it's been interesting listening back and forth to this, and certainly our audience is going to find it very valuable information, especially as we target it as being a winning restaurant franchisor. But, you know, you brought up something in one of your initial comments, John, that I really am hanging on to. When you mentioned about McDonald's and its evolution and as it started to grow, you said that it had a unique leadership team. And in order to be a franchisor, obviously, with an attractive franchise food concept, I mean, what does the leadership team need to do, put aside the financial side, you know, and kind of hang on your statement that, you know, McDonald's had a unique leadership team. What was unique about it, and what does today's leadership teams need to do?
Thank you, Paul. That was a great question, and let me give you my take on not only McDonald's, but what might be broadly right for others going forward, and looking at, you know, things that have occurred, you know, over a period of time. But going back to McDonald's and other industry players, one thing I think is that, you know, these businesses, you know, tend to have an internal culture of promotion from within. And that's very important, and that's why people go into these businesses either as investors or as employees, is to learn and to grow. But sometimes the internal culture gets old and stale and focused on just a series of things, and sometimes threats from outside, new business developments and the like. I think that fundamentally every organization has to have a mix of what I call old-timers and newcomers, okay? And there is a tremendous amount of creative tension and synergy that occurs when you throw all of that together. And, you know, in our society, in the Western world, in the entire world now, I mean, there are no barriers anymore. You know, what's happening in Greece, you know, has caused, you know, the stock market to go down 400 points today, you know. Everything affects everything else. And there, while you certainly want to preserve an internal culture, you need to be looking at it critically well, and you also need to be bringing people in. Business has gotten so complicated nowadays. You know, Ray Kroc was a salesman. He didn't know financial management, and he didn't have much of an operator spin. So he found Harry Soderbergh, the finance guy, who had a real estate background, and he homegrew Fred Turner, who was really the genius of McDonald's operations. And so the burden was split. You know, it wasn't a single focused CEO cult, you know, as I might call it. Another factor, of course, is that McDonald's in the early years, and still today, you know, I mean, obviously you hear that today, is that they became really the masters of detail regarding their operations. You know, restaurants, of course, have, you know, thousands of transactions and thousands of things that have to happen properly every day to please customers and to pull it all off properly. And McDonald's knew the details, and they worked it. Their first operations manual, I think, was created by Fred Turner in 1955 or 1950. Well, by 1957, I think, and that's amazing. And you know, I think those are two overall themes that others could emulate, you know, I'd recommend those two points highly.
You know, it seems like when you talk about a lot of the great companies, even outside of the food service, you start talking about Apple and Disney and Zappos, Amazon, and of course bring McDonald's in, and there is that word detail, that attention to detail, that's absolutely paramount to where they are today. And, you know, you had mentioned, and you and Joe were talking about, you know, McDonald's, and talking about White Castle, and we've all heard that great comparison of why, you know, one grew to its size and one hasn't grown quite as large as it should, and the difference between franchising and deciding to run it as a company operation. But, you know, nowadays it's been widely reported that many franchise restaurant brands over the last 15 years have shifted from company-owned units to franchise units through refranchising efforts. You know, why that shift? in your opinion?
Sure. And Paul, you're exactly right. In the 70s and 80s, the mantra was company operations rather than franchisee operations. Truly, you can see this when you go back over time and explore papers. I think it occurred, and the forces to do so still are strong. There are companies that do extraordinarily well with no franchising at all. And of course, one is Darden, you know, the tremendous casual dining operator, and secondly, Chipotle, you know, the quick casual company. No franchising, no thoughts in mind. Darden is moving off, you know, a little bit to do joint ventures, you know, internationally. But the focus to refranchising came about for several reasons. First of all, as financial standards and reporting got tighter, people began to realize, it's not just the operating profit that pops out of this box, you know, this franchised box here or this company-operated box, but, you know, restaurants and other like businesses are capital intensive. You've got to rebuild it. You've got to renew it. You've got to put new equipment in. You got to it's a big capital expense. So as the concept of more than just profitability, but actually what's the profit after the capital expenditure began to take hold, franchising was seen very much as a fast way to grow. You know, if you go back to Dave Thomas at Wendy's and ask him why did he franchise, well, he said, you know, it's because I couldn't grow any other way as fast. So it was a growth factor. It's also, of course, become a return on capital invested factor, particularly for publicly traded companies. You know, the White Castles and the In-N-Outs, they're privately held, of course. They're not held to the same standard necessarily that a Yum Brands, you know, might be, or that a Wendy's might be. So the level of scrutiny and investment community focus on return on investment capital has caused a lot of this. And then secondarily, of course, you know, the focus to a worldwide sales platform, business platform, it does make it easier, and it does logically provide for franchise growth, particularly overseas, because someone else there might understand that particular nation market better than you did. But those are, I think, the things that have led to the vast increase of franchising in the last 20 years.
Sure. And Joe, you had, we were discussing, you had a question about John's opinion about FDDs and FPRs. Why don't you share your question with John regarding those?
Well, I mean, you know, I think, and you've already kind of answered some of that question about whether we ought to, whether a restaurant franchisor should have the imperative to have an Item 19 FPR, financial performance representation, and you kind of alluded to what, or you were actually quite specific about what needed to be in it. Do you think that you can have an investment-grade franchise concept that does not have an Item 19 FBR and be successful in attracting those high-quality, sophisticated franchisees?
The Item 19, of course, could always be the disclosures that we've talked about. And by the way, what I had kind of proposed today is no owner cash flow, no debt service, none of the stuff below the basic four box, you know, returns, because that's what makes it complicated when you look at different ownership structures and the like. But I think it's possible in that one could always reveal their company operated trends. If you only have company operations at one particular point, then you can show that. If someone literally has no history at all, no company operations, no existing franchisee operations, or maybe even franchisees that have just begun, I think you say that. And that becomes part of the necessary disclosure and the necessary seeding the market, you know, if you will. Of course, eventually you're going to have some history, because of course nothing sells like success, and we all know it. So I would see the principal stumbling point would be just literally those extreme startups that have no history either on the company operated side or franchisee operated side.
Well, you know, and no show on Franchise Today would be complete without talking about best practices and franchise sales compliance. What's your sense of restaurant franchise concepts that may have a financial performance representation or may not, who are actually revealing that information in a non-compliant way? Do you think it's a big problem, a small problem, only isolated incidents, or do you think it's widespread?
Right. Thank you. I think there's a triumvirate, if you will, or a three-way split. You have a very few number of operators. McDonald's principally comes to mind, because not only in their franchise disclosure document, but also in their earnings calls, you will frequently see McDonald's talking these numbers. I think you have about 50 to 6, well, a majority, but particularly, if I had to put a number on it, maybe at least in the space that I have examined. And of course, we all know that restaurants is a fairly mature franchising delivery vehicle. So, you know, restaurants and franchising go way back. But about 70% would reveal some kind of sales statistic in terms of either same-store sales, which, you know, doesn't tell you, of course, what the average, you know, absolute sales level is, or they would show a gross sales concept, which is they would show, you know, United States averages. And then, you know, there may be, and there are another maybe 25%, just in my view, and I don't know that a detailed study has been done, but I'll certainly look to see it. But there are some that don't disclose anything. There are some that still would maintain, well, it's illegal to display any item 19 disclosure. Unfortunately, that's a really backsided view that is not going to sell or is not going to work in today's very credit-constrained environment.
But do you find that those folks that say, you know, incorrectly that the FTC won't allow me to make an earnings claim, at the same time deliver one in a circumvented way?
I know from my long experience that we all know that it happens, because, you know, those folks are in the sales game too, and logically no potential franchisee is going to sign up without trying to determine what is their potential return. So you know that it happens. You know that it happens offline. You know that it happens during the sales process, you know, somehow. And, you know, that's where, honestly, a lot of people that shouldn't be a franchisee get caught into the game and then cause problems later, litigation problems later, and fundamental problems later for that particular operator.
So I take it you're an advocate.
Well, John, we're running out of time. It was a great having you on the show today. Certainly, we have a bunch of questions that we can continue to ask, and easily could have extended this to 2 hours. So I'd like to invite you on the show again in the future and expand upon our discussion. But I really appreciate you being our guest today.
Thank you. I would love to come back.
Joe, why don't you give a quick reminder of who's coming on next Thursday?
Next Thursday is going to be Ben Letalian. Ben Letalian is the principal at FranchiseWell. He's involved in social franchising, aligning your franchise brand with charities, and he's also an adjunct professor at Georgetown University, and he teaches a course on franchising. And Ben will be a terrific guest, and I hope you tune in next week.
And until next week, I'm Paul Segreto, wishing you the best, the very best, in this great thing we call franchising. And Franchise Today is out.